the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
Back hour two on this Monday, and I literally was saying, you know, let's take a break and come back. And just as I said it, I think I heard Rich in the background. Richie, you were there, weren't you?
Yes, I was. That's fine.
I'm good. I'm sorry. I did. If I'd realized that, I would. It was. It was too late.
Not at all. Get the break in. This way we can run off.
That's true. Which we're both eligible to do at any time. Well, you know, it occurs to me. We talked to Jeff Canizzo on Friday about Susie O'Kane, but it occurs to me that you had to have had a long relationship with Susie and Doc.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really sad when I heard the news. Just a one-of-a-kind human being. Really a lovely person. He used to love to go visit them in their two-seat box in Saratoga. Just wonderful people. I was reached out to Naja Thompson and Tom Gallo, and just said how we, you know, really have to put together a nice tribute for the New York Breeders dinner for her. And I even suggested I'd love to see us have some sort of an annual Susie O'Kane Award for, you know, the unsung heroes, the people that are foaling and doing all the stuff behind the scenes. You know, pick somebody worthy of an award that honors an incredible person and somebody that has meant so much to the New York breeding program. Just really a beautiful person. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to see her again.
Yeah. And I, you know, she'd been on with us, I think, going back to the Find a Cure stable,
I've got a funny story about that. Oh, my God.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, so they had some retired racehorse out in a field at the farm, and they wanted to do a photo thing in Saratoga where I would wear the silks with the pink ribbon and, you know, the silks they designed for that.
Yeah.
You know, Find a Cure. And they brought this horse out of a field, and no one had been on his back in, like, 2 years. And I go, I'm getting on this thing, like, you know, and I was still riding, you know. So, he'll be fine, he'll be fine. Well, I got on this horse, and he blew up. I mean, he was like he had been broken before, right? And I wound up getting launched, and she called Doc, and Doc comes over, and they took him behind the paddock, and said, well, he'll be better when he comes back. I said, I really don't want to get back. I'm like, no, don't worry, Doc will take care of him. So he tranquilized him. Of course, his lip was hanging. I got back on him. He was asleep. But it was just like, as soon as I don't want to get on, he's just, no, honey, you're okay. It'll be fine. Yeah, it'll be fine. He launched me about 40 feet in the air.
And that was supposed to pass for a racehorse in the photograph.
In the photograph. But the funny thing is that, so after the fact, and you know, he had a big belly on him because he'd been out of field. In the photo, like, he's on a racehorse, like, it's like a winner's circle, like a, you know, mock winner's circle photo thing. This horse's head is on the ground after Doc got through with him. His lips hanging, he's half asleep. Like, they put toothpicks in his eyelids to pick his head off. Like,
I had forgotten. In fact, I talked to John Parada over the weekend yesterday, and I forgot to bring up with him because he let them run Phil the Power, who Tony won a stake on Phil the Power for John, but you know, they That was during that period where it seemed like there was like a whole rash of leasing of horses. You know, you could lease a horse for publicity means, and that's kind of what it was. And she did that I think with a handful of horses, but they had one nice horse that or one horse that was most regularly associated, and I want to say. Not Larry the Lip. It was something. Call Me Larry? Was it Call Me Larry?
Call Me Larry. I think you nailed it. I think that's what it was.
Call Me Larry. Was their big horse, the Find a Cure stable. That was he was on the Derby trail for about 10 minutes. made a cameo.
But like Susie was one of those people, like we'd be at a TRF board meeting. And it'd be like just some serious topic and like catch each other's eye. And when you're a kid and you got a friend that you cut up with and you start laughing at an inappropriate time, or, you know, like you're in church and you're supposed to be, you know, praying and you start like, you know, trying to hold back the giggles. And that's what it was like with Susie. Like we would look at each other, just something would strike us funny and just start laughing when we shouldn't be laughing. And then the harder you try not to laugh, the worse it would be. And, her and Doc gave me a ride back from one of our TRF benefits a couple of summers ago, and just, you know, the laughs and you know, the comfortability. Like, you know, I can get on with people and I can talk with anybody, but there's a different level of comfortability with some people where you're friends and you know, like you're with
sure.
just good people. And her and Doc, you know, I can't imagine how he feels. My heart goes out to him. As I just, they were so in love, and just a beautiful relationship. And like I said, you know, I'm just sad I'm never going to get to have those conversations with her anymore. But I certainly hope that Doc and I will continue that. She really be sorely, sorely missed. And not to jump off topic here, but when John was just managing Due Process Stable for Bob Brennan, they had a horse named Violato. Bill Birch, Elliot Birch's son, was training. And we had to fly to the Ohio Derby. He was the favorite. And on the way there, we're in the jet with Bob Brennan, and he's telling us how we're going to have, you know, dinner on the way back. And we took the plane out of Teterboro. We supposed to come back into Teterboro. Well, the horse ran terrible. He was the favorite, hated the track, jumped up and down, got beat 15 lengths. We got back in the plane. Well, there was no food. There was nothing to drink. There was Bob sat in the back. No one was talking. I leaned over to Bill Birch. I said, hey, we're having some dinner. Like, be quiet. We didn't go back to Teterboro. We went to Garden State. We had to get a car service to take us back. It was like, wow. That's when you say, man, don't fly with the owner.
Penthouse to the outhouse. It's
oh my god, we went there with so much hope and we came back with our tail between our legs. I won a race like earlier in the card and I was so happy. It was the first time I rode Thistlebounds. And the horse won. Like, I literally think the horse made like $2,200. Like, I got $200 for winning this race, and I gave this horse a cherry ride. Like, got through on the fence, won by a nose, and I was all happy. Then Violato runs terrible. Like I said, we got on the plane, and man, we're like looking at each other, twiddling each other's thumbs. We're like, what do we do? You know, just be quiet, be quiet. So then that's like me being a clown. I leaned over to Bill Burch. Hey, how about that dinner? Where's that food at?
No soup for you. No, you know when you get nothing.
Oh my god! And then we didn't even go back to where our cars were. We landed in Garden State, and Bob Brennan walked away, and me and Bill Birch are like, I guess we got to get a. You know, we didn't want cell phones yet, right? We went into the little terminal there. We call in, and we got a car service to come pick us up and take us back to Teterboro.
You know, another Due Process, kind of an ill-fated trip as well to Gary and John tell me the story about Daniel, my brother, was going to run in the Spiral. And he had won the Battaglia, and he was coming back for the Spiral. And John and Gary are together. They go out for, you know, a bite to eat. This is on Friday. They come back to check on the horse after dinner, and the groom, they come up. Everything okay? Horse cough. What? Horse cough. That was it. That's it. Scratch. Bad trip. Ugh. The wasted, you know, complete wasted effort to go. So clearly, Northern Kentucky to Cleveland was a bad stretch for due process.
Well, you know, it's just so funny too, because like I was excited to go to, you know, you're a kid. I maybe was 19, 20 years old, and you're just so excited to go to a new track. And I had nearly left New York when I first started to go ride at Thistle Downs because I got beat on a favorite that was supposed to win when I had 10 pounds and, you know, kind of was really, really down in the dumps. Like, you know, how did this horse lose? Maybe I don't belong here. And Al Olfie was a jocks agent. He had been a retired New York City detective. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, the Frenchman's Kitchen would open up, and I'd always have a cup of coffee with him at 5 a.m. before I headed back to the barn to start work. And, you know, I was telling him, you know, I was kind of down in the dumps. I might have blew my shot. And he had a friend that trained at Thistle Downs, had a lot of horses. I really don't remember the guy's name. I want to say it was like Jim Burton or John Burton. And we called from the payphones outside of the Frenchman's. And the guy was like, yeah, no, Al told me you're a good kid. Come down here. I won't ride you on everything, but I'll give you a real good shot. And I went so far as to get a bus ticket at the Greyhound terminal down in West Hempstead and went in to talk to Mr. DeMauro, like, you know, I'm going to go to this smaller track and get polished up and I'll come back, you know, someday. And he said to me, no, you're not going anywhere. You know, and he put me on 3 horses that Friday at the Meadowlands and 2 of them won. And I obviously, I never went to Thistle Downs. So when I went to ride Violato, that was my first time going to Thistle Downs, and it wasn't lost on me that I was originally going to go there on a Greyhound bus, and here I am in a private jet with Bob Brennan. And, you know, those things were always meaningful to me. Like, it was just, like, almost surreal. Like, I remember being, you know, 16 years old, leaving to go there to ride on a bus, and now here I am flying in on a jet. Like, how blessed am I, right? You know?
That's a great perspective. And you know, one thing, in fact, now you got me, you're going to make me bring up jockey, which we touched on, I think, last week. And I finally got a chance to see it yesterday. And it's going to start to spread from L.A. and New York, just limited markets, which was an opening essentially to qualify for the Academy Awards. And Rich, you talk about a smaller track, and the thing is set at Turf Paradise, and people are going to really, really be taken by this. It's a quiet, you know, small story. You know, character driven, and it absolutely does a brilliant job of, you know, capturing, you know, the racetrack and the lifestyle and you know, the challenges, the you know, both personal and professional, and I just thought it was everything that I'd been reading. It sure came through. I think people are going to just be delighted by it.
Yeah, I'm glad you felt that way. I did too. It really touched me. I mean, you know, from somebody that, listen, I've been fortunate. I got to compete, you know, at the highest level pretty much my entire career. And, you know, I was at Turf Paradise once. I won a stake on a horse called Leonides for Vladimir Serin. That was the first time I ever met Scott Stevens, who's in the film, Jockey. But it hits the mark. I mean, it just, the struggles are so real. It's right in your face. And, you know, again, I'm a little bit worried about giving too much away because I want people to see it and kind of come up with their own conclusions. But that one scene when he's basically looking at a part of his body that won't do what he wants it to do, and just knowing that struggle, how he captured this, Clifton Collins Jr. was absolutely amazing in this role. Like, I just looked at it, and that was me. That was me, you know, going through some injury or some struggle that you're almost angry with that part of your body that won't cooperate. God darn it, do it. You know, like, he is phenomenal. I mean, I think the whole cast is phenomenal. I think they were fantastic, but I really, really impactful movie.
We're gonna talk to Cliff Bentley, the director, and then any number of the participants. And what's great about it is, from a character standpoint, and an actor actress, they don't call them actresses anymore, just as an actor basis, being familiar with the three principles is part of at least for me, part of the appeal, because Collins is not as easily recognizable, I think, for people. But once they hear, you know, where they probably saw him most prominently was in the Redford Gandolfini movie, Last Castle.
Yeah, he was terrific in that too. I mean, I always make the comparison. Jockeys and actors are so similar in the respect that, you know, when you start out as a jockey, you'll ride any horse. You scour the backstretch; they'll throw you on anything, you know, and you'll take it. You know, and I often say somebody like Tom Cruise, you know, one of the biggest movie stars of our lifetime, probably has a commercial someplace that he's embarrassed about, right? But it's the same thing with a jockey. You ride horses that other people wouldn't ride, and you have to win or make the most out of those mounts to get better mounts. So as an actor, you're going to make the most out of those. Maybe they're not good parts or good characters or good films, but your performance is such that you start getting offered better roles. Does a jockey better horses? Does an actor better roles? And then you get an agent, and you become more selective, and you build a resume, and now you want the Academy Award-winning roles, or as a jockey, you want the stake horses, you want the better horses, and you try to avoid the worst ones because those are the ones that get you hurt, those are the ones that get you suspended, those are the ones that make you look bad. Same thing with an actor. There's such a parallel with the process of how you become a successful jockey, how you become a successful actor, and Clifton Collins has got a role here that I think showed the depth and breadth of his abilities. I mean, he did things that I thought only guys that had actually lived through that struggle could portray, and does it in an incredible way. And even without, again, I'm just going to be vague, you know, he allows himself to be very vulnerable and talk about something he's going through to the trainer of the good horse that is, like, you know, his last, you know, kind of big shot, and how it costs him because he allowed himself to be vulnerable and open up. And as a jockey, you learn early on, you don't let on, you don't talk about, to trainers anyway, about, you know, some of the struggles you're having, and because then they go, oh, I don't want to worry about that guy, you know, I can get someone else. You know, listen, when I was struggling really bad, after I broke my leg and didn't get to ride Artie Schiller, I was very depressed for a while. Even when I came back, I was riding and I was winning, but I was like, okay, I just won a $25,000 claim, but it wasn't Artie Schiller in the Breeders' Cup. And you don't let on to anybody you're struggling with that and feeling that. And I got mad at myself, Steve. I said, you know, what am I doing or what am I not doing that made me as successful as I was in the past? Well, I wasn't working as hard. I said, I'm going to go back to basics. I'm going to be like I was when I was 16. Now, a little tougher when you're in your 40s, right? And I'm going to start hitting the barn area every morning earlier than everybody else and stay late than everybody else and just walk through everybody's barn. And my pitch was, just give me one. I want to be alive in your barn, even if I haven't ridden you for you in a while. Give me one. I want to be in the batting order. I don't care if I'm batting ninth. And I walked into a trainer's barn that I had had a lot of success with in the past. And I said to him, I said, you know, I haven't been riding for you. Just give me one. I just want to be in the rotation. And he said to me, nah, I'm not going to do that. He says, I can ride younger guys that don't have your battle scars. And it hurt so much, but that's how people were looking at me at that point. And that's when I made the decision to go to California, kind of reinvent myself, got my career back on track, and, you know, didn't finish exactly the way I wanted, but at least I, you know, knocked out a couple more grade ones, won a Breeders' Cup. But that, the scene I'm talking about in the movie, it spoke to me so much about that struggle I was going through at that moment, even though, yeah, you're friends with people, you have relationships, it's a business, and they're going to do what they think they have to do to be successful. And if you don't fit into that plan, you get kind of pushed to the side. And that's, this film touches on all of that. And probably the best racing film ever made with the least amount of actual racing scenes or horse scenes.
It's funny. It's one of my. Well, I kept some notes, and that maiden, the maiden win when the filly that Molly Parker has bought and developed wins. It you never actually see the horse running, and you see the win in the face of Collins, and it from that standpoint, exactly, it's amazing how little actual, there's some background scenes with horses working out and a few cutaways from races, but it's really done without any race sequences that are usually used for dramatic effect. And I think it's a big positive, especially based on some of the reactions we're seeing, Rich, from critics. There's some critics who are put off. They've even written in their reviews that they're put off by racing as a sport. But that this was so winning and so effective at asking the audience to have an interest and an affection for the principals. And we mentioned Collins and his role as Aguiar in The Last Castle. Molly Parker, as a completely crazed Deadwood fan, having Molly Parker in this as the main trainer and sort of quasi love interest of Collins, it is such a treat, because she's just fabulous. And I thought that she embodied a lot of familiar female trainers to me. The kind of the Helen Pitts, Michelle Lovell, Carla Gaines agglomeration. I thought she was just spectacular. And then there's the young apprentice or young journeyman, who's a kid that if you want to see, his name's Moisey Arias, and does he look like a young jock or not? It was unbelievable. You want to see him in a lesser seen film before you get a chance to see Jockey, The Kings of Summer, and the three friends and a girl involved. But the three friends are the Kings of Summer. It is wonderful, and that's the first time I saw Moisey Arias. He's a terrific little actor. It is just great. And then, of course, there's that scene we should talk about, the jocks circle. I thought there were so many things, Rich, that were so accurate and evocative. The chaplain, and I'm sure that's the Turf Paradise chaplain, giving the invocation before the race day. That is so real. And then there was that jock circle with Scott Stevens and Marlon St. Julian and those guys sitting in the circle telling those stories, and that was a winner too. That seemed like that was an attempt to just you know, give everybody an understanding of, you know, of what it's like to be a jock. And also, what about the injured rider? I'm going to forget his name. Leo, who gets hurt.
Well, you know what's like interesting about that too is then like even how difficult it is for other riders to go visit a rider in the hospital, because you always, you know, that could be you, and it's difficult. That was one thing I remember getting so banged up on Memorial Day that year, the one they did the Rescue 911 on, and Eddie Maple came to see me, and you know, I'm in a halo and I'm all banged up, and he walked in and listen, I really look up to Eddie Maple. He's one of the guys that really meant a lot to me through my career, and still, you know, we talk, and I have such admiration for him. He walked in, and one thing about Eddie, has very little filter. Like, sometimes he just say things to come out. He walked in and said, "Oh, damn, he's really messed up." Like, Mike Benizia would come every day, but a lot of guys would avoid it. You know, it's just difficult. Yeah. It's just hard, you know, and they kind of, you know, they touch on that there. And then how about even when, I think it was the apprentices, you know, yeah, man, I broke my ankle, broke my arm, broke my collarbone, you know, nothing major, you know, like, that's how jockeys think. You know, I've had that conversation with Angel, and, you know, jockeys break collarbones the way you stub your toe. I mean, it's, you know, that's like a not even a big deal. Like, okay, a month, 6 weeks, I'll be back, but Eddie, you know, I mean, excuse me, Angel said, he goes, yeah, the only thing is spine. He goes, I never, that was the thing that bothered me. And he always made me feel good, he said, because he was always impressed that I was able to come back from such bad spinal injuries and, you know, compete at the level I did. And that always made me feel good because, you know, Angel's a tough son of a gun. I mean, he rode through injuries and, you know, his level of passion never waned, you know, and he was that kind of competitor. So it's, you know, the movie really hits all of the right notes. And it doesn't have to be that you're a racing fan or you're that knowledgeable about racing. I think it really just talks about the human struggle, the struggle when you want something so bad that you're willing to sacrifice and dedicate yourself to something, whatever it may be, whatever it is that your passion, your desires are, that you're willing to give so much of yourself. And maybe it gives people a little bit more of window and insight into a rider's life that, you know, just it's a constant battle. I always make the joke, guys win the Kentucky Derby, and they don't, you know, they don't go, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to Disney World. No, they're flying back to California or New York or someplace to ride the next day. And, you know, it's over. I mean, yeah, obviously it's not over in the sense that you've accomplished this great thing, but you're on to the next thing. There's no season. It's constant. You don't have team support. I remember Jerry Bailey telling me after he won the Derby on Sea Hero, he had a chicken club sandwich in the hotel, you know, to catch a flight out the next day because he had to go ride. I mean, you know, it's just an incredible life that I think this film definitely kind of opens up the door to. But again, anybody can relate to it that's ever endeavored to do something different and had to give so much of themselves to do it.
Well, I got a few responses, but when you mentioned the collarbone, and given that Scott Stevens has got himself a film credit out of this, when you say you're breaking the collarbone on a regular basis, I should check with Hovde or Parada or Bill Barish who wrote the line when Stevens gets dumped on the backstretch in one of the early episodes of Luck. Ronnie Jenkins, and he rolls over and reaches up and says, "Break this bone more than I get laid." he said it a little bit more colorfully, but that was one of the great there's so many great moments. Ugh, unfair that we got robbed. We was robbed. The one thing that you hinted at it, and I had expected actually to bring this up with Tony as part of the discussion, and it'll come up, you know, when we have when we have the director. But the thing that it got, the central element, Rich, is the fear. And Tony has talked about this, and you've talked about it, but I mean, Tony has really specifically addressed it, that when you demonstrate that you're afraid, that it's basically like a rash, and everybody sees it, and everybody knows, and you might not know it's time to hang it up, but everybody else does.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. Listen, you know, courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is being able to do what you have to do despite the fear. You know, being able to react. Now, as a jockey, you can't go out there afraid of the consequences or what could be. But you also, as you get older, you realize there's certain situations you want to avoid. You know, it makes you smarter. But when you're going out there feeling like the hammer's going to drop, it's time to go. I see it. It's easier to see it for me now when I watch races because I'm not as immersed in it. Like, you can see the forest through the trees, and I see the riders that struggle with it. And I struggled with it at different times, you know, come back off a bad injury. And, you know, people don't realize how hard you have to work to get your body back in shape. The first time I broke my neck, I got up to 143 pounds. I was on a steroid regimen to help promote healing. I had to get down to 112 from 143. Anybody sees me now, I'm 145, and I'm not heavy. So I killed myself, not just I had to get back in shape, but I had to lose weight while I got back in shape. And I went to a nutritionist. I tried to do everything, properly. And I was living on maybe 800 calories a day. And I got down to 120 and couldn't lose an ounce, could not get down under 120. And I went back to the nutritionist and I said, listen, we got to cut some things out. You know, like, I didn't want to go back to flipping and all that. What are we going to cut out? You're living on the bare minimum of calories you can live on now. And I had to, you know, revert back to, you know, pulling water out of my system to get down to 112. The last 8 pounds just was not, there was nothing to lose. So you know, people don't realize just how difficult that is. But now you come back from the injury and you've struggled through all this. The last thing you want to do is get hurt again. So, you know, you see a situation running and you get that, man, look out, you know. But I used to get mad at myself when I got like that and go, wait a second, you stop this nonsense. Like, basically, cowboy up. This is your life. This is what you do. And risk and reward. The reward was always greater for me than the risk. I was addicted to the feeling of the competition, the adrenaline, the winning. Carmella made a joke when I finally did retire. It was very hard for me to relax. It took me a year to eat more than one meal a day. I just was so conditioned to not. She'd say, you want lunch? And I'd be like, why? You know, like I couldn't wrap my head around that. So, you know, having lunch was such a foreign thing. She said she was going to sneak up behind me every half hour with an air horn and, you know, surprise me so I would get like that adrenaline jolt like I was breaking out of the gate. You know, it's such a way of life. But if you struggle with that and like now that fear is a constant companion, find another line of work. You can't do that job if you're worried about what could be. And I'll say this, a lot of times people, particularly trainers, retire a guy before he's actually done. Like, you know, he just doesn't have the heart anymore. And it's not always the case. You know, I see guys that ride very, very hard and don't have any fear whatsoever. Mike Luzzi's as fearless a guy to this day, and I think some of his injuries just doesn't get the opportunities anymore. But it's just funny how, you know, I heard things about me when I was riding. I rode to the end with all of my desire. There was not like one part of me that was like, I don't want to do that. I mean, listen, I rode Lloyd Dobler with a broken neck and we got beat, but Steve, I don't think you could ride one any harder. It wasn't like I was, you know, worried about what was going on with my body. I was trying to win, and the consumption with success, wanting that feeling of the winner's circle. I won 4,450 official races. And I still think about the ones that got away. I still think about the one I got DQ'd on. I still think about, you know, I can remember the ones I got beat on better than the ones I won on, because those are the ones that consumed me. You want that feeling, and it transcends money. It's such a satisfaction, such a good feeling. I mean, Angel loves to show tape. He and I went like head and head for the last half a mile, pulling out all stops. Of course, he beat me, so he shows that one. I said, "Why don't you show one that I beat you?" When we threw it down from, you take a pride in it. You take a satisfaction in it, and listen, I love the game. I love every aspect of it. I mean, I think we need to do a better job promoting it, and I think we need to do a better job to keep it a level playing field, and hopefully that all those things are going to happen. But I love the game. I love the promise of the game. I love what the game delivers, and what you hope the game delivers. Everything about it is special and magical, and the relationships you make through the game, the people, the horses, the experiences. You know, the places I got to go in my life, I never flew on a plane in my life until I became a jockey. And then, like, I'm 16 years old and I'm in Tokyo riding the first Japan Cup. How does that happen? It's all of these things that racing has and horses in particular, have given me and provided for me. It's just really, really blessed. And my fervent wish, and I hope that it comes through at times when I'm doing television, is that I convey how special the game is, how incredible the horses are, how incredible the people are. You know, you cast the characters that just an incredible cast of characters and people that, have their little idiosyncrasies, myself included, but it's the most amazing, it's the greatest game played outdoors, and you include anything, and I'll stand by that till the day I die.
Well, and when you talk about the magic, one thing, tying everything to watching, getting a chance to see Jockey yesterday, just the fact of how the public that aren't familiar, they're going to see a racetrack, and they don't know anything about Turf Paradise other than that, the references that it's in Phoenix, and yet the movie makes Turf Paradise look like Santa Anita. It makes it look like absolutely, bathed in this gentle light and absolutely gorgeous. And it's funny. I mean, that also fits the dialogue about why it's important for live racing to be accessible by anybody, and why I take issue, and why anybody should take issue with the people that say, "Oh, we don't need the Suffolk and the Fairmonts and these C tracks. We'd be better off without them." When somebody goes to a racetrack the first time, and it's not Saratoga, if they go to Suffolk, if they went to anywhere, Rockingham, any place, the Fairmont, they don't know the difference between a Derby horse and a Nickel Claimer, and an exciting race that got them to cheer for a Nickel, it's just as moving and as thrilling as a Grade One stake at the biggest circuit. And without that equation, without that thrill and thrall, the game is got a problem, because you can't cultivate players and potential owners and serious fans of the game that will immerse themselves in the sport. So that, to me, that was another interesting sidelight to what I, what I got out of watching Jockey yesterday.
So many things are going through my head as you're talking about it, because I happen to speak with Doug Thomas, former jockey, rode New Jersey circuit for years, and he lives about half hour from Turf Paradise, and we were talking, just, you know, catching up about things. And I guess Danny Need, who also was part of that jockey county, he lives in Phoenix as well. And, you know, those guys moved out there, and they're big fans of America's Day at the Races. They watch the shows, so it's nice catching up with them. But I wish that I could give a gift to everybody, that feeling. And you say, and this is any track, anywhere, anytime, of getting up in the dark and heading out to the track, and how you get into the barn and it's quiet and it's dark, and it, and the anticipation of getting on one or working one or seeing one work, and your pulse quickens a little bit, and that feeling never waned with me. Like, from the start of my career, like, I couldn't wait to get up early in the morning in the dark and be a part of it, be in the barn, be immersed in it. And I remember when I got out to Santa Anita, now, again, this is much later in my career, the first day it was 4:45, and I'm driving down Baldwin, and I come along that hedgerow at Santa Anita. I felt like I did when I was under contract, when I was 14 years old, and getting to the barn. Like, I it was amazing that I could recapture that feeling of starting out again, that excitement of just being there. And you know, Bill Spahr wound up becoming a very close friend, and he's a tremendous horseman, a great horseman. And he's at his barn, you know, before 4 o'clock in the morning. So my routine became, he was my first stop in the pitch dark, and you know, talking horses, and that sense of history of a place like Santa Anita, like a Belmont, like Saratoga, but that exists also. I remember Rockingham, winning a stake for Dennis Bryder at Rockingham, and going up to the press box, and there's all these pictures of all the great riders, Tony DiSpirito and Eddie R. Carroll rode there, and it still had that sense of history and this timeless kind of mystique to it that I wish people could experience that side of it. Like, I do these history backstretch tours at Saratoga, and cluing people in to the different barns and different things and the history behind them and the great horses that were there. Like, I wish they would put plaques to commemorate every great horse. Like, this was Secretariat Stahl when he would summer in Saratoga. This was Seattle Slough, Affirmed, whoever it may be. And again, pulling back the veil and letting people see that side of it. And I think jockey does that. I mean, the film itself, just the, you know, the morning thing and getting a horse ready. And I still don't like to use the Western bridle, but I'll let that go.
I love it. Well, we'll have more. We're certainly going to have more conversation about jockey, and certainly offered, I think, the appropriate tangents that it connects to. And, you know, Rich, there's a few things that already came up here that I want to utilize as a jumping off point, because, well, I'm just looking up at the clock. We're going to start to get pressed.
Well, I heard you talking about the Safe Florida Sandy Stakes.
Yeah, why don't you? Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, I'm certainly gonna, you know, root for Gary and Eddie to get put up, but there's some odd things that happened in there, including the fact that, in a lot of ways, it seemed like it was Carmouche that on the runner, on eventually the horse that got moved up to second, seemed to initiate a lot of what went on.
Well, this is my take on it. In full disclosure, I didn't wager on the race. I don't have a dog in the fight. I could definitely make the case that Battle Station should have come down. He did come in, and he contributed to the crowding. But at the point that Chestertown was impeded, that was more on Eric Cancel and my boy Tate. And I broke it down on the America's Day at the Racing show yesterday. He got crowded in. He had gotten through the spot. He was heads up. And when he went right-handed, there is daylight between him and Carmouche's horse. And that's at the point when he takes Chestertown's ground completely. Chestertown has to check. when Eric Cancel went to that spot, he has a responsibility to the guy inside of him, which turned out to be Jose Lascano in Chestertown. He only has a finite amount of room to work with. The rail is there. He can't go further than that point. So it's not like he has room to continue to float. You're going into a fairly difficult spot, and you have to anticipate you're going to get some outside pressure because nobody wants anybody to get through, so they're going to lean on you. Now, I do think that Battle Station could have easily come down as well, and I think that probably would have been the right call. But I think my boy Tate had to come down because at the point that Chestertown was impeded, it's when Eric went to his right-handed crop, came in another step or two, and there's daylight between the two horses. You're not seeing shoulder to shoulder. You're seeing 6-8 inches of daylight, and that's all it takes. The onus is on the rider that put himself in that spot to put his horse's head and shoulder, at least have the head cocked out, try to protect the guy. And I think that Eric did to a certain point, and then it was like, oh, I'm right there to win. And then he kind of gave in to, I just got to go forward, to heck with it, you know, and wasn't as responsible as he should have been. I think my boy Tate was the best horse. I don't think that can be disputed. I also think Lobster, and for people who don't get my sense of humor, I said it yesterday on the show, Lobster showed it was no fluke. I don't know if anybody picked that up, but his last race was no fluke. So, but I think that my boy Tate had to come down. And I know if I was Jose Lascano, I would have been upset with Eric because You've got a responsibility. You've got to take care of that guy a little bit. He can't. There's no place for him to go. There's a buffer. There's the rail there, and he shouldn't have gone to the right-handed crop. I tried to get them to pull a race, and the only reason I wanted it to be this particular race, and it was a horse that I rode, was because that's what I could remember. I can remember the incident. I rode a filly Full and Fancy in the next move. And I come through the eye of a needle, and I've got somebody inside of me, and I never went to the crop, and I kept my filly's shoulder on the horse outside of me to make sure I didn't take that horse's ground, and I was very careful about it, and she got up and won. When you head to that spot, the onus is on you to hold as tight a line as you possibly can, and he did until he went to the right-handed crop, and that's when Chestertown got bothered.
No, I get it, I guess there's actually Andy and I were talking about it yesterday, and I guess there's two schools of thought to a decision taking that long. One school is that, you know, once it gets to, after a few minutes, you realize they're gonna do something here. They're taking a horse down. But then when it goes beyond that, there's almost like a Best Buy date. And when it spoils, you say, if it's taking this long, then they should leave it alone, because now you're wondering, are they trying to, you know, they're going to do something, and now they're trying to make sure they're justifying it, so to make it feel like it's the correct call. It's like a weird, there's like a weird timeline when they're looking at the replay.
Well, I think probably took so long trying to decide if they were taking both of them down. That's what I was thinking. And I honestly, though, I understand what everybody's saying. Like, if it's not that clear cut and you can't make a decision quicker, then leave it alone. But I don't subscribe to that so much. I just think, get the call right. I don't care if it takes you a half hour. Just get the call right. And like any DQ, you're always going to have, you know, factions, sides. Well, you know, it affected some people, their wager, or whatever it may be. But I think at the end of the day, the way I explained it on the show yesterday, it should make some sense, even if you don't agree with the call. You know, there was a point where there was separation between the two horses, and that's the point where Chestertown got bothered. I would agree with anybody, though, that would make the argument that Battle Station should have come down as well. And I tell you what, it could have been a lot worse if Jose Ortiz, whose horse was tiring, like, didn't get out of there as carefully as he did, trying to make sure he kept room for my boy Tate and Chestertown. If he had allowed himself to get shoved over, and it's easy to happen when you don't have a lot of horse under you. That, my thing when I was riding was, if you get me when I have horse, hats off to you. You outrode me. You got me in a spot that I shouldn't have got in because I had horse. But if you took advantage of me when I was dead, when I had no horse underneath me, that's a cheap shot. I can't protect myself. That's when I would get mad. So Jose, who was out of horse, did a really good job. And you can go back and watch from the head of the stretch of going, oh, man, these guys are going to really be in big jeopardy if I allow these horses to shove me over. And he actually probably saved from a real bad jam.
Yeah, it was interesting, and there were quite a few. It seemed like there were a lot of steward moments, at least that I kind of ran into over the
somebody had said about
over the weekend.
And I got to be honest with you, I never did see it. I happened to just get back to the house in time to watch the Safe Florida Sandy. And it's, you know, reading the chart of the race, and I meant to go back and look. I just been busy, but I mean, it sounds like it was a very roughly run race, seventh race. And anybody who has a problem with consistency, I get it. I mean, you know, if you're just talking about this one incident, that's my take on it. If you didn't take the Remsen down, then no, you shouldn't take this down. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, we can go into that. That's like, but that's a whole nother argument. That's a whole nother conversation. But in this particular case, I think they got it right, and they could have maybe gotten it more right and taken Battle Station down as well.
We'll get Andy's take tomorrow. Rich, after that, I suppose, well, we really, I think I have to go because I've got to get Tony Lacey in here as well as Joe Clancy. We've done it again. We managed.
I'm not back on America's Eighth Races till January 29th, so I got a little free time here. I got time to maybe do a little hiking and certainly
nice
farm work, but I'll be back on the 29th, and always look forward to my Mondays with Steve.
Well, I will talk next week, and look forward to it. Everybody, this has been really one of the nice, not surprise additions, but one of the really, you know, nice, consistent visits that has come up, as always.
I know I'm still the only guest you've ever had that spoke to you from the top of Catterskill Falls.
That's, there you go. There we have reached a few people in crazy places. Hammer sometimes when he's traveling or when he's vacationing, I can think of. And there was a very famous conversation with a jockey on a beach in Bermuda.
On that note, I'm going.
and also the pub conversation, the first win that when Wesley got the first win at Ascot, and we reached him, 5 hours ahead, and they were passing the phone around at the pub. Those are some of those special, unique venue conversations.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, I got an idea for a segment that I want to pitch for America's Eighth Race. I'll talk about it with you next week when we have more time.
You got it. Rich Migliori, everybody. You follow Mig. Thanks, buddy. Mig 4450, the new address for Rich Migliori on Twitter. And I'm putting up you mentioned the injury that he was dealing with when he rode Lloyd Dobler. You've heard me say this, I mean, a dozen times over the years. It would have meant, I mean, he gets beaten in the closest stretch duel, and it, a win, I mean, obviously, would have just, it's always nice to have wins, but it would have been the last win of his career. And we still talk about, and we still talk about it, you know, glowingly, but that would have meant, boy, would have to have had the, you know, to have been that tie to And I'll put up a picture. I got Skip Dickstein happened to be there because it was, what day was it? Was it a, I can't remember if it was Gotham Day or was it, might have been Wood Memorial Day. And we were on the undercard and got out-dueled Channing Hill and a very nice horse by the name of Cavallo that was, may have been from the first Tappet's first crop, and may, it was a you know, big gray, and Skip Dickstein was there anyway, and so Skip took unbelievable pictures of the race, and you know, we've had horses that have fallen short. There's certain ones you know you want to break the maiden with, and or win with, you know, sometimes the claims. This was such a hard luck horse. Unbelievable. I mean, we shouldn't, by all rights, we never even should have gotten our hands on him. This was a horse that, had he not, he colicked before a sale. And had he not colicked, I mean, we never, you know, he would have gone for, you know, for real money. And he had a, I'm going to forget the sibling. He had a sibling that was a stake horse. And he's gorgeous. I mean, just an absolute gorgeous chestnut with a big blaze. And he colicked, so they couldn't go through the sale. And so we ended up getting him through. Chuck made a deal with Case Clay. And we got him and Redboard King and I think two others, and the other two never made the races. Redboard King did, and was a nice enough horse. This was a horse that, I mean, could have been any kind, and he just had no luck. It was just unbelievable, just a bad luck horse. And to this day, people because of the name. This was the horse for the, because this came up not long ago. This was the horse that I tried to name after Harold Carmichael. Because he was by Smarty Jones, and the dam's name was I Aim High, I think. I Aim High? And it made me think, I was, you know, Philadelphia, Smarty, I Aim High, made me think of the Fire High Gang. The Eagle receivers, Harold Carmichael and Charles Johnson, right? And Zimmerman? The Eagles had three very tall receivers. They called them the Fire High Gang. And so I Aim High made me think of that. So I tried to name the horse after Harold Carmichael, and the registrar's office said, you can't, you know, you need permission. So I got through to Harold, who works as community relations for the Eagles. And Harold was sort of bewildered by the whole thing. He was like, what do you mean? I want to name a horse in your honor. Well, what do I have to do? I said, nothing. You have to give me permission. I don't know. Harold didn't really get it. He said, call my agent. Explain it to him because I don't. I'm a little uncomfortable, so I couldn't name the horse. And it was getting to be February 1st. You know where you got to name the horse. You know if you name the horse after February 1st of their 2-year-old year, it costs you $100. Not that that's a big ordeal, but if you can name them for free, you name them for free. So. it's getting to be. I think it's like January 30th or 31st, and I forget why I even made the connection, but you know, for those of you that are fans of Say Anything, you should recognize the name Lloyd Dobler, and so I put them together: LLOYDOBLER, Lloyd Dobler, and the name was a hit immediately. I think, if I'm not mistaken, when that year, which was probably, what, 2013, 14, it was, I think, the 20th, I think I saw that it was the 20th or 25th anniversary of the release of Say Anything. And so, that's how he became Lloyd Dobler instead of Harold Carmichael. Let's take a break. Top of hour three. Tony Lacey is going to join us. We'll check in at Keeneland. We'll see how everybody adjusted after the weather woes of last week. And Joe Clancy is going to join us. And Joe and I will go through the Eclipse ballot and do some back and forth on our decisions. There's a couple categories. The turf category was a disaster. The males, the females, not a big deal. The male turf horse category to me was a nightmare. Back after this, hour three at the races on this Monday. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them, is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless